Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, taking a look at the two games that happened on Wednesday, the other first legs of these quarterfinals. PSG 2, Liverpool 0 at the Parc des Princes, and Barcelona 0, Atletico Madrid 2 at the Camp Nou. I'm Jack Collins, and I will be your host today, and this is a solo mission. Dean is currently on a flight back over the Atlantic between London and San Diego, so you're stuck with me. And just before we get into these two games, I did just want to give a shout out to the great Mircea Lucescu, who died earlier this week at 80 years old. The great Romanian manager, one of the most successful coaches in history, who'd only stepped away from the Romanian national team following their playoff exit at the World Cup qualification stage a few days ago. Won the UEFA Cup with Shakhtar Donetsk, in the Super Cup with Galatasaray, widely seen as one of the great coaches of his generation, raised a number of incredible players under his tutelage. Andrea Pirlo speaking out afterwards and saying, he was like a father to me. We know that Diego Simeone was one of his early pupils as well as a player, and obviously went on to be a wonderful manager in his own right, as we'll discuss in this program. But thoughts and prayers with the Romanian people, who absolutely loved Lucescu and who, under his management, you know, reached a World Cup for the first time in a long, long while, back in 1994, I think it was. He was, you know, an incredible, incredible manager, a true tactical visionary, and someone who had an incredibly successful career. So thoughts and prayers with anyone associated with Lucescu, with his family, and a sad day for football. I thought it was a lovely mark that there was a moment of silence at a couple of these games to mark his passing, because he was such a wonderful, wonderful manager and someone whose influence, I think, on the world game perhaps sometimes goes unnoticed. So I wanted to just start with that. And then we'll come over to France and the Parc des Princes, where they did have a minute's silence for Mircea Lucescu. 2-0 to PSG over Liverpool. And let's start with the PSG of it all, because this was absolutely scintillating stuff at times from Paris Saint-Germain, the only home team to win across all four quarterfinals. And look, I think on the surface, the first goal is obviously a deflection, Désiré Doué finding some space in the box, drifting around a couple of players, and then firing one off Ryan Gravenbeck that looped over Mamardashvili in the Liverpool goal. The second one, far less iffy, I suppose. Absolutely beautiful from Kvaratskhelia. Wonderful through ball from João Neves in the midfield to release him. He cuts back across goal, has a little pause, which is beautiful. Just allows him to drift across his national counterpart, Mamardashvili, and slot the ball home. But a really wonderful, wonderful second goal from Kvara and from PSG. And they were unlucky in many ways not to be more than 2-0 up going into the second leg. They had chances missed. Dembele spooned one over the bar. He hit the post late on as well. Nuno Mendes should have probably done better late on. They had a penalty overturned correctly. They had another penalty shout late on, and a couple of really good saves from Mamardashvili to keep Liverpool in this. And ultimately, the way that PSG play is such a joy, right? The positional freedom that they have. And I think that at this point, they are perhaps the best purveyors of the Cruyffian ideal in Europe right now under Lucho. It does just feel like the way that they switch positions, the fact that Vitinha is almost certainly the best string puller in Europe right now, the general behind this incredible fluid front three. And I know that, you know, you could listen to an episode at this point last year when we were talking about PSG and thinking very similar. But I think they've dealt really well with some setbacks this season. It was a difficult first half of the campaign for them. I think they were really struggling with fitness issues after the extended Club World Cup and getting all the way to the final in that after an incredibly long season where they finally ended that European trophy drought. But when you kind of look at what they're putting together now, and I think that Zaire Emery deserves immense credit for being able to step into the shoes of Fabian Ruiz. I kind of have always been of the opinion that this PSG side are better when Fabian Ruiz is in the equation. I think he's another one who's kind of contributions to this side perhaps go a little bit under noticed, underrated. But I think that, bear in mind, Warren Zaire-Emery, as a young player who's kind of been on the scene for quite some time now, who obviously had such an amazing breakthrough and then had to kind of take a little bit of a back seat, has really stepped up this season, whether that being a right back in the absence of Achraf Hakimi. I thought he did an excellent job standing in there, even if he can't do the same things that Hakimi does. I thought that he offered something slightly different and was able to deputise there in a pretty nice manner. But coming back into the midfield here, I thought he was a really key part of the way that PSG just dominated this game. Hakimi and Mensch are the best fullback combination in Europe by some distance at the moment. And it feels to me like PSG are going through the gears at the right time. They've opened up what now looks like an unassailable lead in Ligue 1. And they're taking advantage of struggling opponents, should we say, in Chelsea and Liverpool in the Champions League. I think the frustration will be, from a PSG perspective, that this tie is not over when perhaps it kind of could and maybe should have been. They were a little bit wasteful at times. As I say, Mamardashvili coming up with a couple of big saves as well to keep Liverpool at least within striking distance. But this was a tale of two sides, and look, we'll come on to the Liverpool of it in a second. But I think when you're discussing what PSG are capable of, and what they're able to put together on the pitch, the way that they interchange with each other, the freedom that players have to go and express themselves, and then this incredible blue-collar work rate, which remains within the heart of the team. I don't think they're perfect. I don't necessarily even think that they're quite as good as they were last year. But when they do turn it on, they are one of the best watches in all of Europe and have been for some time. And it does feel like the right players are coming back to full fitness and form at the right moment of this campaign. And we're seeing someone like Kvaratskhelia, who obviously scored such a wonderful second goal, as this joyful player on this left-hand side, where he's taking on his fullback over and over and over again, where he's starting to slip into positions and take shots. I think that there is a fearlessness about PSG, and I'll counteract this in a second when we talk about Liverpool, but they play with such verve and such panache that even in games where they lose, I tend to kind of watch them and think, yeah, well, a couple of things have gone wrong there. But most of the time, if you continue to play in this kind of style, you're going to get the results you deserve. Now, that might be an easy thing to say about the European champions and about a team who wins far, far, far more than it loses from a domestic standpoint as well. But given all of the wobbles this season, given going out to Paris FC in the Coupe de France, given the fact that they have got to this point through going through the playoffs, etc., again, for the second time running now, it didn't hold them back last year, but you would have expected them maybe to kick on. It just does feel to me like Luis Enrique is doing a very good job of finding the moment where he's able to hit the accelerator at the crucial part of the season. And in some ways, that feels quite Real Madrid, right? Like, for so many years, we've spoken about Real Madrid as looking a little bit wobbly, looking about a little bit shaky in the group stages or league stage of the Champions League. And then when it comes to the spring, you know, when the daffodils bloom, that team starting to find its edge again. And suddenly you come into these Champions League knockout stage and you're thinking, oh God, they're a completely different animal to what they were in the first half of the season. And I think that PSG have learned from that, right? I think that whilst they won't have wanted to kind of start the season slowly, the flip side of that coin is that when they do get to this moment and they are starting to get those players back, and look, we're in kind of unprecedented times in terms of the amount of games that teams are playing, etc., especially those who had that kind of long spell in the Club World Cup, they found the right moment to start putting it all together again. And I think that's scary for absolutely everybody else in the competition. Now, look, I think the Bayern are the best side in Europe right now. There's a truth coming out on Friday where Sam and Duya are discussing that very question. But when you look at this PSG team and what they're capable of doing over the course of any given 90 minutes, I give them far more than a puncher's chance at this point of retaining this trophy. And considering where they were at the start of January, for example, that feels like a long way back, and it feels like a very, very different side to what we're seeing out on the pitch today. As I say, I think their only real frustration with this will be the fact that the tie is not put to bed, because there was one team in this game and that team was Paris Saint-Germain. The start of it was obviously the ultras doing the banner and the tifo, which was the Incredible Hulk pulling apart the Liverpool crest. And it was interesting that when you kind of go back a year and we saw these two meet in the Champions League last time out, we saw Liverpool win at the Parc des Princes. Now, look, you can argue till the cows come home about whether they deserve to win that game or not, but it was an Alisson masterclass in goal, and Harvey Elliott obviously coming up with the goods late on for Liverpool to snatch a win. Obviously, PSG turned it around at Anfield and won that game on a penalty shootout. But the difference is so stark, I think, from where the two teams were last year. If you look at PSG, they feel like they're very, very close to what was happening last year. They might not be quite as good, but they're very, very close, and they're playing a very, very similar style. The difference in Liverpool, and we'll come on to them now, the change in aura from when they played PSG last year to this is very significant. And this was a really fearful performance, I thought, from Liverpool. They feel absolutely all over the place, and that crest being ripped in half might be a kind of visual representation of where this Liverpool side find themselves right now. There are schisms between the manager, between the fan base, it feels like between the players as well. And this is obviously two games in a row where they've been made to look very much second best. First by Manchester City at the weekend in that incredible spell either side of half time where Liverpool's defences completely collapsed and their mental state seemed to break down. They've obviously changed the setup here to prevent something like that happening again. But the problem was that the setup almost felt like it put them on the back foot and they had no way of getting out of this. So they played a three at the back system for the first time in about 8 years, right? Like this, we have not seen Liverpool set up like this for a long, long time. And look, I actually think the next iteration of Liverpool might suit this, but to throw it in at this point felt like a real, real stark admission of a lack of quality in this Liverpool side. Now that's nonsense, right? Like as a discussion point, there is not a lack of quality in this Liverpool side. It's imbalanced 100%. The squad doesn't feel like it's set up to compete on multiple fronts, but there is not a lack of quality here. And to effectively utilize the game plan as being sit in and try to survive, I think is a real, real stark admission from Arne Slot that he is not capable right now of bringing out the quality in this team and trying to put together a really defensive performance. Now, a little side note on the three at the back, because I don't think it is necessarily a super defensive formation by nature. And there'll be people that disagree with that, and that's absolutely fine. But I think that if you watch a Xabi Alonso three at the back system, for example, it was initially put in at Leverkusen because they were conceding far too many goals. But I don't think you could have watched the latter iterations of Xabi Alonso's Leverkusen and said that that three at the back system was something that, you know, was set out primarily to be a defensive force. That's not the case. So you can have three at the back formations, which are very much forward thinking, which are trying to get the wing backs high up the pitch and into play on a variety of times. This was not that, right? Like this wasn't that. And Arne Slot afterwards spoke about them being in survival mode. But was he actually coaching here? Because he spoke about the fact that Milos Kerkez and Jeremy Frimpong were being asked to track the runs of Hakimi and Nuno Mendes, which is fine in principle, but both of those players had relative field days. It meant that the front three were man for man against a Liverpool backline that has been creaking of late. Virgil van Dijk not looking his imperious self at the moment. We know that Ibrahim Konate has had a very difficult season for most of the campaign. And Joe Gomez has been asked to play in a sort of very strange left centre back hybrid role where he was asked to stretch out to left back at times. Didn't feel like it particularly suited him either. And so if you're talking about being in survival mode, you know, Liverpool didn't throw any punches, which, okay, fine, but they conceded 2.2 XG over the course of it. They conceded two goals. They conceded four big chances. This is not a team here where you're looking at it and think, oh yeah, they defended really, really well here for 90 minutes. Because they didn't. They were grateful to Mamardashvili for a couple of excellent saves, but you're going to need that at the Parc des Princes. Like PSG are a really good side. They didn't stop PSG creating. They were grateful for some profligate finishing, especially from Ousmane Dembele. They were grateful for the fact that a couple of decisions which were given on pitch were overturned, I think correctly, but obviously these are things that will play into the hands. They were saved by the woodwork at times. It wasn't like Liverpool set up like this and then suddenly were incredibly defensively cohesive, because they weren't, right? Like they still gave up chances. And whilst you can point to elements of this Liverpool performance and say they didn't capitulate like they did against Manchester City, if this game had also ended 4-0, I don't think loads of people could have had loads of complaints about the way that it was, the scoreline not reflecting the manner of the game. You know, Liverpool not registering a shot on target. First time we've seen that from a Liverpool side for about 6 years. I think it was Atalanta in the Champions League under Jurgen Klopp. And Klopp was absolutely fuming after that game about the fact that they weren't able to create anything. They never really looked like they were going to create anything in this game. And so it comes back, I think, to Arne Slot. And also, bear in mind that Arne Slot has complained all season long, right, about low blocks and set pieces and long throws. He set himself up as a purist. Now, look, you don't have to be one thing or another here, right? Like, I personally prefer watching attacking football. That's, you know, as a neutral, especially in these games where there are no kind of, I don't have a horse in the race in the Champions League, and almost certainly never will, right? But if you set yourself up as a purist and then you put this out there on the pitch where Liverpool are hurling long throws into the box courtesy of Joe Gomez, I don't think that you can be on both sides of that. I think you have to pick a lane. And whether you are a pragmatist, it's totally fine. Pragmatism is completely reasonable. We are in an era, especially in the Premier League, of pragmatism. But if you've spent all season railing against that and then kindly go out and set your team up like this, not for me, Clive, I don't think. I don't think that you can have it both ways. You can't complain about that all season long and then utilise it. That's not how this works. And look, I suppose from a positive perspective, Liverpool will be grateful to still be in the tie, maybe. And we know that Anfield can produce those spectacular nights. But this was a scared performance from Liverpool. And every Liverpool fan I have read, heard, or spoken to since has been severely, severely disappointed by what that team put out on the pitch. I thought Henry Winter had it right. He wrote a piece about Liverpool's history, especially in European competition, being fearless, that maybe they didn't have the players of the technical ability that they do right now, but it was a team who would go out there and they would go toe-to-toe with absolutely anybody, sometimes to their detriment and sometimes to their eternal glory. And the idea that this was a Liverpool side who really resembled former Liverpool sides in Europe in the fact that they were wearing a red shirt with a live bird on their crest and almost nothing else, I think is the truth of the matter. This is not what fans want to see. It's not what, you know, Arne Slot has promised. And I think we are coming to the point here where it looks untenable for Arne Slot to be in charge of this team next season, because there has been so little offered in the back half of this campaign to suggest that there is a way forward. And look, there's sympathy there. There's sympathy for the situation that he has found himself in. It has been unprecedented in what he's had to go through this year with the death of Diogo Jota. It has been an imbalanced squad that he's had to deal with, despite the fact that there was plenty spent last summer. Yes, plenty sold as well, but plenty spent last summer on some incredible talent that has left this side very, very imbalanced. But I think that ultimately, if you are going to have that many incredibly talented players, you've got to find a way of making them all work. And right now, Arne Slot is not suggesting that he has any solutions to the problems that Liverpool find themselves within. So, yeah, I think it's a disappointing night, a really disheartening night for Liverpool. And yes, you can two things can be true at the same time. Liverpool were really poor, PSG were really good. Both of those things can be true without necessarily being into isolation. And it doesn't have to be that PSG made Liverpool look really bad or Liverpool made PSG look really good. Both of those things, you know, can be true at once. But I think that we're here at a point in, you know, the halfway stage within the tie. And even with the majesty of Anfield on a European night, I think you would struggle to find many Liverpool fans who genuinely believe that they're going to turn this one around, especially given the fact that PSG went to Anfield last year against a superior version of Liverpool and found a way to win at Anfield and then win on penalties. I don't think you'd find many Liverpool fans even believing that they will take the tie to 120 minutes this time round. It feels like PSG are too strong, and it feels like Liverpool are about to almost cut their losses on this season and have to kind of reset and restart and have look for alternative solutions when it comes to the summer. Right, let's take a little break there. On the other side, going to talk about Atletico Madrid's incredible win at Barcelona. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Jack Collins with you to go through Wednesday's action. And let's get over to Catalonia, where it was Barcelona 0, Atletico Madrid 2. Let's start with Atleti. And what was a bit of a strange game, the headline is that Atletico Madrid have won a Camp Nou for the first time in almost 20 years and for the first time in Diego Simeone's reign as manager, ending Barcelona's perfect streak since returning to the renovated stadium a couple of months ago. And look, this was dogged and defensive and all the things you might expect from Atleti, but it was a timely reminder that whilst they remain attritional as their kind of beating heart, there is serious, serious quality in this team. We've talked a fair bit about rotation and the fact that the squad is broad and I think broadly just good rather than great. But there are three absolutely mesmeric talents in this side, in Lookman, Griezmann and Julian Alvarez. It's a long punt from Ruggeri that lands at Alvarez's feet for the key moment because he takes one touch and sends Simeone Jr. screaming in behind and there's contact with Kubasi as last man that ends up with Kubasi being sent off after a VAR check. And Barcelona fans will rage about the fact that Simeone initiated the contact, but ultimately I do think this is a tangle of legs and that the red card is the right decision. If there is no contact there, I think that Simeone scores. And therefore, you're kind of looking at it as the obvious denial of a goal-scoring opportunity as the last man. And there's a frustration around it, I suppose, from a Barcelona perspective, because I think that Atleti were very, very lucky to get away without a penalty and a red card of their own, with Marc Pubill handling the ball in the box after the kick-out from Juan Musso. And Pubill is already on a yellow card at that moment, and we have precedent here, right? Tyrone Mings against Club Brugge in last season's competition for Aston Villa, where the ball is played out to him by the goalkeeper. He puts his hand on it and then plays a short goal kick back to the keeper. Penalty is given and a yellow card is given to Tyrone Mings. So I think that Atleti are incredibly lucky that that wasn't punished more harshly. But I do think that the red card for Kubasi is ultimately the right decision in that. And look, people will have different opinions about that, and that's absolutely fine. But in my opinion, I think that the referee has got that right after the VAR check. And obviously, Julian Alvarez scores the free kick that is given here. He makes it look like a penalty, has been discussed in a variety of different outlets. And punishing the opposition at that moment is an absolute hammer blow for morale. Because if you give away a penalty there and it's scored, I think that's kind of the expectation, right? That you've brought someone down, there's a penalty given, but a free kick on the edge of the box, you've just gone down to 10 men, you're in a couple of minutes before half time, and you're thinking, okay, well, as long as this free kick doesn't go in, we're probably okay, right? Like, we'll get to halftime, we'll reset. And Alvarez just bends it into the top corner, away from the despairing dive of Juan Garcia. It is a beautiful, beautiful free kick. We don't see that many, I think, especially in the Champions League, direct free kicks scored. There are obviously a few players who have kind of nailed it, but it seems to be a dying art in some regards, the act of the direct free kick. And I know Szoboszlai scored an absolute wonder kind of selection of free kicks over the course of this season, but it's not something that we've seen loads and loads of. So Julian Alvarez, who, you know, is starting to find a little bit of heat at the right time after a long drought, right, does feel like he's just clicking into gear at the right time for this Atletico Madrid side with a absolute beauty, a golazo, as Simeone described it after the game. And you kind of look at that moment and think, okay, how is this going to respond and what are Atleti going to do? And the answer was not loads. And you can understand why to an extent. Obviously, you've seen them this season tear Barcelona apart at times. The 4-0 in the Copa del Rey first leg in particular. But it never felt like this was going to be one of those games. And it felt actually that with 10 men, Barcelona were probably more reticent to actually end up committing as many players forward. Now, that didn't mean that they didn't dominate in the second half. And I thought it was interesting that Atleti were like, okay, the first thing we do here is we defend a lead. Despite the fact that we've got the extra man, we will sit in and we will go back to basics, make sure that they don't score, and we'll take a lead back to Madrid for the second leg. They do get the second goal. Sorloth scoring in the second half was Atleti's only shot on target in that 45 minutes against 10 men. But I suppose in some ways it's par for the course, right? He loves playing Barcelona. 9 goals now for him against the Catalans. It's a great ball from Ruggeri. And it was one of the few kind of forays, I suppose, from Atletico Madrid. I thought that Simeone got his tactics really, really spot on here. And obviously it's Sorloth coming off the bench to score the goal. But more than that, it felt like in the second half, at least of the first sort of 20 minutes or so, Barcelona had all of the ball. They were really struggling, Atleti, to get a hold on it and make things happen. I thought that Robin Lenormand was absolutely excellent in the defensive line. Now, he's had a bit of a shaky time at, I was going to say start there, but not a start. He's had a bit of a shaky time across his time at Atleti, I think, since that move from Real Sociedad. But this felt much more like it, much more like the old Robin Lenormand, who was very, very impressive in the second of the park as a kind of totem pole for them to work around. But actually, if you looked at, you know, the midfield that started was Koke and Llorente, but the substitutions I thought were interesting in that Alex Baena came on for Koke. And also what they did was they brought Griezmann back into the midfield line when they brought on Sorloth. And I think what that did, interestingly, was it allowed the Atleti midfield, which at that point then had Simeone on, had Griezmann in there as well, to be able to actually start to switch play, to open the game up a little bit more, and to take advantage far more of the extra man by these quick switches of play, which felt like it changed the tide just before that second Atleti goal. And once they get the second one, Atleti do what they do best, and they actually drop back into their defensive line, their formation, they go two goals lead that we were going to take back with us, and we're very, very happy with what's happened here. I mean, look, that's always going to be the way with Atleti, but they will be absolutely over the moon that they've decided this is the moment to get that first win in almost two decades, as we say, at Camp Nou, and for Cholo to get his first win there as Atletico Madrid boss. Yes, they lost at home to Barcelona in the league at the weekend, but we've talked about rotation. There was plenty of it, and we saw a couple of players like Alvarez, like Griezmann, held back for these Champions League ties. I feel like Simeone knows that, you know, his best chance of doing things in this season is going to be that Copa del Rey final and then the Champions League. And look, how great would it be for Antoine Griezmann to lift the Champions League trophy, the trophy that has eluded them, as his final action as an Atletico Madrid player? Like, I loved Cholo's press conference about what he's brought to the table, but also the fact that he remains his manager and he's going to shout at him if he doesn't run in the next game, etc. But what an incredible servant to the club he has been. And, you know, despite the fact that he left and went to Barcelona and had to come back and effectively appease the fans and show why he should be given their trust again, an incredible footballer, someone I've absolutely adored over the entirety of their career. And if he was to go all the way here with Atletico Madrid, I still think that's a very, very long shot. Although I do think that now they will progress from this tie. Like, it would be an incredible story for him to lift this trophy of all trophies as his final action before he heads off to Orlando in MLS. But let's flip it to Barcelona. And it's a weird one because from a Barcelona perspective, I think there was plenty to be quite pleased about in general. Although they were profligate in front of goal, notably, I thought, Marcus Rashford, who did hit the bar from a free kick. But it was a weird counterpoint to Marcus Rashford's season. He's generally been a bit quiet in open play, but clinical in front of goal. And this was the absolute opposite. I thought he looked excellent with the ball. I thought he made things happen in terms of going at his fullback, but just really wasteful in front of goal, which has been, yeah, the opposite of what we've seen from him most of this season. And plenty to like, right, about this Barcelona performance. I thought it was a bold use of a 4-3-2 with 10 men from Hansi Flick. They dominated the second half in terms of having the ball. They made Atleti look like the side with 10 at times, but they remain vulnerable. And this is why I love watching Barcelona, right? They're a fundamentally flawed side who play exceptional attacking football. They're a neutral's favourite in so many ways. And I do think that flaw and that lack of complete dominance that we have seen from Barcelona, obviously at times in the last sort of two decades or so, adds to their allure. Because when they were so good that they were passing teams off the park and they felt invincible, I think that a lot of people disliked watching them, not because they weren't playing good football, but because it felt like they were creating this sort of super dynasty that changed the face of football forever. Now, I didn't particularly feel that way, but I know that some people did. I think that when you're looking at this Barcelona, with their ability to implode, with their ability to concede, with their ultra-reliance on a high line. And I do think it's dropped off a little bit, as it did at the back half of last season. But there are still vulnerabilities there, as you see, for the red card and obviously the Alvarez goal. And, what Cabasi is doing there, chasing back, is because Barcelona are so committed to the way that they play football. And look, I love watching that in so many different ways. And these flaws, right, they catch up with them again against Atleti. And that is now 6-0 they've lost on aggregate in two knockout first legs this season against Los Colchoneros. And they have a huge, huge mountain to climb at the Metropolitano. Of all the teams currently losing after their first legs, I still give them the best shot of qualification. Lord knows they can score goals for fun. But it does feel like to win by two clear goals at Atleti is going to be a massive, massive ask, especially when Atleti can now just sit in their shape and they'll be willing to counterpunch with the talent that we've already spoken about in the Atletico Madrid section. I think with Barcelona, they really need to work out what's going on up front. Lewandowski looks a shadow of the player that he was last season. Ferran Torres is so incredibly out of form that Barcelona are discussing potentially selling him when it comes to the summer. I think they're already really missing Rafinha. His wherewithal in the press, I think, is so crucial to that high line being effective, because without him, players have so much more time to pick a pass out of the back and make things stick. And you see that at moments in this game. Rafinha's quality, his ability to turn a game, his goal involvements, I think it was 8 in the previous 3 games before he went off on international duty and was obviously injured with that Brazil team. That feels like a massive blow. And at the time, I wondered if that was going to be the difference between Barcelona potentially excelling in Europe or starting to struggle. And it already kind of looks that way a little bit, despite the fact that they were good for large swathes of this game. And I am interested because this Barcelona side is, you know, relatively young, bar Lewandowski up top, I think. When you're looking at what they've put together, Joan Garcia coming in, I think, was a big piece of the puzzle, a wonderful goalkeeper he is. And it feels like they're starting to exert a dominance from a domestic perspective that we have seen before from Barcelona. But I wonder what the fan base feels about this. And look, I don't think that many people would have had Barcelona in maybe even the top 3 favourites of the 8 teams left to go and win the Champions League. But we know what they're capable of on any given day. And the fact that they made the semi-finals last year and ended up crashing out to Inter in that incredible semi-final over 2 legs, and just the swings of that game would have upped expectations that perhaps this year things could have been better. I do think that the lack of Lewandowski's influence is starting to show. And whilst last year we praised a lot of the fact that, you know, he's back to goal and directing traffic a lot, it does feel like he's just not as involved in games anymore. And there feels like Barcelona are so reliant on going down Lamine Yamal's wing when Rafinha isn't in the team that the onus kind of shifts onto him. And obviously there was frustration, although I thought he played really, really well again yesterday. And at times he had Rogeri on toast. You kind of look at it and think, well, if you teams know that that's the goal threat and that's where it's coming from, are they going to double, triple mark Lamine Yamal? Look, even sometimes that's not enough. But like, it gives you this kind of sense that if you're going to try and shut Barcelona down, can you do it in one particular way? Yeah, I think that's the case. So it'll be very interesting to see if they go maybe with the false nine system that we saw at the weekend when it comes to the second leg of this one, whether we see Dani Olmo up top, potentially supported by Fermin, who I thought did quite well again when he came on. That might be the way that Hansi Flick starts to go with this in the next couple of weeks, because Lewandowski's influence is waning. And the fact that, you know, Ferran Torres has not scored, I think it's 12 La Liga games, and his last goal in the Champions League was in October, I think speaks for itself at this point. So they're going to have to find a different solution to what we've seen so far. But, you know, as I say, I still think the Barcelona are the team who are losing right now who have the best chance of turning their game around in the second leg. But if you had a gun to my head, I would suggest that they maybe win in Madrid by not by enough to end up qualifying for the semi-finals. I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting, I was talking to Sam Adugi about this last night, was that in some ways there were mirror images of the games on Tuesday and Wednesday. Because actually, you know, if you break down what happened yesterday, you know, we have PSG, good but wasteful. Liverpool, quite bad, but could have been worse. Barcelona, pretty good, pretty fun, losing 2-0. Atleti, not that fun, winning 2-0. And if you go back to, you know, the day before and Tuesday's action, you got Bayern, good but wasteful. Real Madrid, quite bad, but could have been worse. Sporting, quite good, quite fun, losing 1-0. Arsenal, not that fun, winning 1-0. So we have similar things going on, I think, in terms of what it looks like. And I do think that we are starting to see, the pragmatism perhaps of the Premier League this season start to run into some walls when they come up against the best teams in Europe, in the world at times, because that fluidity and that ability to pull a team apart is finding a way round the pragmatism and the physicality that we've seen across most of it. And look, some of that is down to the fact that there is an incredibly competitive Premier League from a physical standpoint, and I will accept that argument. But also I think some of it comes down to the fact that when you ultimately bring football down to a level where, you know, that physicality is the main thing, and we've seen this before, right, in the Champions League, and we've kind of swung around the roundabouts in some ways, and you go back to Jose Mourinho's Chelsea and Rafa Benitez's Liverpool, when you kind of over-rely on physicality, I think that you can be outplayed and outgunned by teams who are more willing to get the ball down to dominate possession and try and create from open play. I think we're starting to see that in some regards. And whilst Arsenal remain the exception in terms of the team that are winning, they also, I think, had a strange performance. So you got a comment about Arsenal on yesterday's podcast about the fact that it's not just about enjoyment. And look, I agree with that. I said on the time that in so many ways that Arsenal game was the perfect away performance. And arguably you could probably point to Atleti against Barcelona and say something very, very similar. But I also do think that when it comes to it, and if you do come up against a PSG or a Bayern, these are the sides that are going to start to move you around and tear you apart. And how that steps up in the second half of this season, as compared to some of the performances in the league stage with the pressure on, it's going to be a really interesting watch, I think, for lots of it. And if we get Atleti versus Arsenal in a semi-final, I think a lot of people are going to be talking about Simeone versus Arteta, the Sufferball derby, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it will be a really good game, I think, a really, you know, big game of attrition and a good battle and a good fight over two legs. So I think there's plenty to be excited about as to what these semi-finals might end up looking like. I think it's been a very interesting couple of days of football. PSG being the only home side to win, I think, is really, really interesting in terms of what it means for, you know, obviously the teams who are seeded lower are those at home first. And ultimately, it's been the top seeds who have come out on top in the most part, with the exception of the reigning champions, which you can kind of look at and be like, okay, fair enough. There are some things that you can't quite quantify via the seeding system alone. So we will see. But I think we're set up for some very, very interesting games next week. And with that, I'm going to pull this to a close. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of Champions League Takeaway on Ranks FC. I've been Jack Collins. And we'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.